Men are women, women are men. And the assault on science, common sense, truth, reality, and genuine compassion continues. Welcome to World News Brief. I'm Mike Fredenberg, and I'm honored to be one of the rotating hosts for World News Brief that also includes Bob Siegel, Jim Barrier, JP of JP's Political Matrix, and the original host of World News Brief, Winston Holland. This week, we'll be looking at and analyzing a number of issues and topics, including the continued assault on reality, ongoing CHICOM encroachment on Taiwan and why we should care, and associated military matters. But before plunging into national world affairs, I want to give a tribute to one of my favorite entertainers, someone I have followed for decades. My tribute is a little late due to the timing of my podcast, but this is definitely a case of better late than never. The person is Olivia Newton-John, who passed away at the age of 73 on August 8th, 2022. Very sad for me. I'd always thought of ONJ as the gorgeous, all-American girl next door from Australia. I became aware of Olivia Newton-John during the pre-Greece, pre-physical era. This was her country era, during which she had a long string of top country hits, seven of them in the top 10, and several of which also did very well on pop and contemporary charts as well. During this period, my music of choice as a young man was hard rock, progressive rock, groups like Led Zeppelin, Aerosmith, Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Neil Young, Jethro Tull, and on the softer side, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and the Cars. Definitely not into disco or country, and in fact, at that stage of my life, disco pretty much sucked. But for a teenage guy, ONJ became a big exception, at least for this teenage guy. I clearly remember the cover of her 1977 Best Of album. It was a close-up of her face, and she was drop-dead gorgeous. And she had what I thought was the ultimate sweet feminine voice. Making a long story short, I ended up having a crush on her and began to follow her career. Even as I was listening to Van Halen and Deep Purple, I was also listening to ONJ. Sometimes secretly, maybe. Of course, ONJ was not just a pretty face. She is just one of a couple dozen female artists to have sold over 100 million albums. Of course, I already mentioned the seven top 10 country hits, but she also has won four Grammys. Her first Grammy was for Best Female Country Vocal in 1973. Then in 1974, in a bit of a controversy, she won the Country Music Association Female Vocalist of the Year, beating out country greats like in legends, really, like Loretta Lynn, Anne Murray, Dolly Parton, and Tanya Tucker. But she was even more successful in the pop arena with 40 top 100 hits, including five number ones. And probably you'll be familiar with many of these songs. You're the One I Want, that's from the 1977 blockbuster Grease film. Magic, from her not nearly as successful film Xanadu, but it did have a great scene in it where she does a dance with Gene Kelly, and I believe that was one of the last performances on film for Gene Kelly. Her country era, Have You Never Been Mellow, also went to number one on the pop charts, and Honestly Love You also went there. So she really, really had a very successful career, but her biggest hit was Physical, which I believe was 1981, and that turned out to be Billboard's number one song of the entire decade of the 80s. So pretty successful, to say the least. However, she is also known for her decades-long courageous battle against cancer and founding the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute. And as we know, unfortunately, she lost that battle with breast cancer on August 8th, 2022. She was first diagnosed with cancer in 1992, and after surgery, chemo, and radiation therapy, it went into remission. And then it returned in 2013 as a tumor in her shoulder, and then again in 2017 as a tumor at the base of her spine. So I believe that is ultimately the cancer that ended up taking her out. Very sad. But she does leave behind a legacy, not only of great music and wonderful entertainment, but there is her Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute, which was founded in 2014. Since then, hundreds and hundreds of significant medical papers have been published, by the Institute. Hundreds of clinical trials have been led by the Institute, and there's been many hundreds of collaborations, research collaborations with other cancer research institutes throughout the world. So really a significant institute that is doing great work in battling cancer. And you can go there for treatment as well, if you happen to be in Australia or you want to travel there. So that's just, I just felt that I wanted to do this kind of thing on occasion, you know, significant people who have passed, at least significant to me. And hopefully, you know, I'm quite confident there's a lot of you that were big fans of Lieutenant John as well. But on to topics of a more philosophical, political nature. And chief and foremost among these topics, at least for today's podcast, is the ongoing assault on reality. And when I talk about this, what I'm talking about is a whole bunch of issues that at first may not seem to be highly related, but the core of the issues is that we're being asked to believe things that are not true. We're being asked to believe half-truths, lies, or just outright, you know, crazy assaults on common sense. A number of these issues that would include climate change, the renewable energy scam, the whole idea that men and women are essentially the same with some variations in plumbing. Men are women. Women are men. This absolute assault on reality is to try to get us to start to believe that men are women and women are men, and it's simply a matter of identification. Now, if this can become rooted, taught in our schools, and become part of the general thinking in society, then we have lost all hope of ever having reality-based public policy again. I mean, that is the ultimate attack on reality, is the attack on what is a man and what is a woman. But I'm not going to talk too much about that today. I want to start off talking about the climate change attack on reality. Climate change used to be called global warming. However, that was not convenient because there'd be a really, really severe winter, which didn't seem to fit into the global warming narrative. So now we're talking about climate change, yet we still are talking about global warming. Now, there's a lot of scientists that believe in global warming. In fact, in academia, I mean, the overwhelming number of people working on the topic in academia are going to be supporting the global warming narrative. Now, I don't think it's that significant because the bottom line is that if you want to work in academia, you want to get tenure, you better believe in global warming, otherwise you're not going to get tenure. Now, there are some more established scientists, more established engineers, folks that be able to be a bit more independent. In fact, there's over 30,000 scientists and engineers and technical people that have signed the Global Warming Petition Project that don't believe in the global warming narrative. And that includes 9,000 PhDs. That it does include a lot of climate scientists. It includes physicists. It includes engineers. Not every one of them is a global warming specialist or a climate specialist, but these are a group of folks with a high degree of ability to analyze complex data and come to the conclusions. So if you're out there and you are challenging and you have your doubts about climate change narrative and the global warming narrative, there is thousands and thousands and thousands of highly educated, scientifically trained people that are with you on this. So that's one of the first things I do want to mention. But back to just some of the global warming ridiculousness. Okay, so let's just say that there is a case to be made for climate change and global warming. I've looked at it, and I think the case on the other side's perhaps a little better. But I can't say that there is no chance that there's man-caused global warming. But I can say a few things. For example, we've gone beyond talking about, you know, big models talking about long-term climate change and global warming to every news report has a fire. Oh, that fire, the forest fire, it's the result of global warming or climate change. A big hurricane, global warming, climate change. A cold winter, well, that's climate change. It's Mother Earth fighting it back against the evil human beings trying to warm her climate. A hot summer, global warming. Tornadoes, global warming. So now every weather phenomenon is now the result of climate change and global warming. Now, this is unscientific, yet the continuous drumbeat of what can only be called propaganda or the narrative is effective. Younger people are terrified of global warming and climate change. They believe disaster is lurking just around the corner. In fact, a BBC poll conducted in September of 2021 found that nearly 60% of young people approached said they felt very worried or extremely worried about climate change. More than 45% of those questions said feelings about the climate affected their daily lives. And 3/4 of them said they thought the future was frightening. And just over half, well, actually, significantly over half, 56%, say they think humanity is doomed. Now, this is horrific on many levels. First of all, it is bringing a mass amount of unnecessary fear and uncertainty to the lives of people, especially young people. Second, not only do these young people vote, well, at least some of them do, they have and they will continue to move into positions of power and influence and will be supporting and promoting public policy that is based on lies, half-truths, and exaggerations. In other words, we're putting public policy in place that is largely divorced from reality. This has real consequences in real public policy. I live in San Diego, California. In California, you know, we're a very green state, you might say. And recently, I've become acquainted with something called vehicle miles traveled. This is a new regulatory scheme that California is putting in place that will supposedly help reduce our carbon footprint. The general idea behind it is that having people living in highly urbanized, densely populated areas is good, and having people living in more rural, less populated areas is bad. Because if you live in the less populated area, you'll drive your car farther to get the groceries. You'll drive your car farther to get to work. You'll drive your car farther to get medical care, so forth and so on. Get your kids to school. So that's the general idea. It completely ignores the idea that you could be living out in a rural area, have a ton of solar panels, and have a completely electric car, and drive yourself around that way. However, that's not the point of it. The point of it is to reduce the number of people living in rural, less populated areas, and force people to live in highly urbanized areas. So the scheme, that's really the point of the scheme. It adds hundreds of thousands of dollars of cost to build a home out in the rural areas. And of course, it's completely at odds with the idea of affordable housing. As you may know, California has an affordable housing crisis. Housing prices are crazy here. And we don't have enough housing for people that can't afford to pay $4,000 to $5,000 per month mortgages. And rents are crazy as well. Yet, the folks that are pushing the vehicle miles traveled, the VMT's environmental scheme, are also the ones screaming and whining and howling about the lack of affordable housing. So those two goals are really mutually exclusive. Yet, they don't see it. And that's what happens when you start to divorce reality from public policy. You get these public policies that are at odds with each other, yet many of the people making it really don't see it. So here in California, we have so many environmental laws and regulations in place that the cost of building new housing and going through the environmental review process takes so long that, you know, you just can't build housing. A group, I think, are called the 100. It's a group of ethnic minorities have gotten together and have actually declared the current environmental housing scheme and regulatory scheme to be racist, because it pretty much guarantees that unless you're practically a wealthy, you know, two-income family, you're not going to be able to afford a house in California. VMT regime greatly exacerbates this situation. So climate change mentality and the global warming mentality, the hysteria over it, does have a big impact on our lives. And part of that, of course, is the crazy move to try to get everything to renewable energy. Well, it all sounds good, but the bottom line is renewable energy is nowhere near as environmentally friendly as many would have us to believe. Making solar panels has a big impact on the environment. Disposing of those solar panels, which we're just beginning to see the very tip of the iceberg of having to do that, will have a big impact on the environment. But the biggest impact is the fact that we're nowhere near anywhere having enough battery or storage capacity to provide a reliable energy system unless we build trillions of dollars worth of battery storage systems or other kinds of storage systems so that when the sun's not shining at night or the wind's not blowing, you can actually have energy. We're nowhere near that right now. It would take literally trillions of dollars in investment here in the United States to build all these battery storage facilities, these massive facilities. And the environmental impact of mining the minerals and the materials for these batteries and then having to dispose of the batteries is massive. So the differential between, let's say, something like clean natural gas, you know, cogeneration plants, gas turbine, steam cogeneration plants, and the billions of tons of solar panels that need to be disposed of and or recycled, the windmill blades that are going to fill up the landfills, the cost of making them, the cost of disposing them, and of course, the huge, huge problem of disposing of and recycling the batteries necessary, the differential is really not that great necessarily between clean natural gas type plants and the whole so-called renewable energy right now. However, there is a solution, especially if you are one of those folks that is highly concerned that climate change disaster is just around the corner. There is a solution. And the solution is nuclear power. Nuclear power is actually the greenest form of energy, has the least impact on the environment, and nuclear power plants can be made for far less environment impact than it will take to produce, you know, the billions of solar panels, the trillions of dollars worth of batteries, and all these windmills. Nuclear power has been given a bum rap, and there's obviously some concern there. Chernobyl was an absolute disaster. So was Fukushima. It should be noted that the Fukushima disaster, to this date, they've not been able to attribute any specific higher rates of cancer to the Fukushima area. Yet it was a disaster. Chernobyl was a disaster. But compared to U.S. nuclear designs, Chernobyl was primitive, lacked safeguards. So a Chernobyl-type accident literally could not have happened with U.S. reactor designs of the era. And speaking of nuclear reactor designs of the era, we have Three Mile Island reactor. Now, there was a partial meltdown, but because of the design and the safety features in place, only a very, 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 very small amount of radiation was released into the environment. In fact, the radiation in the environment was so small that someone living next to Three Mile Island, literally right next door, would have been exposed to less radiation than if they had taken a plane flight 30, 40,000 feet up, and thus were more exposed to cosmic rays than you are on the ground. So the Three Mile Island design, certainly had a flaw, but the safety features in it were enough to make that flaw a relatively minor accident in terms of actual damage to people and the environment. Today, we have much better designs for nuclear reactors, safer, with more safeguards. And in particular, there's something called the breeder reactor. This is really cool because the breeder reactor can actually take some of the nuclear waste, maybe a lot of the nuclear waste that has been produced by older nuclear reactor designs, and use it for fuel. And it produces much less nuclear waste itself. Other nuclear reactor designs can actually produce nuclear waste that is far less toxic with far less of a half-life. So there is nuclear technology ready and waiting to be put into use that could have a big impact on reducing the amount of carbon being put into the atmosphere. So if you really, really are serious about trying to reduce carbon dioxide being pumped into the atmosphere, there is no better solution than nuclear power. Solar panels, windmills, and producing, you know, billions and billions of tons of batteries to store energy so that you can have a reliable power grid. All of that has a much bigger impact on the environment from a carbon footprint perspective than building nuclear power plants. But don't expect this to happen anytime soon. Obviously, it would take a long time to build a lot of nuclear power plants, not as long as it would to have the massive infrastructure in place for renewable energy via solar panels and batteries and windmills, but there's still a lot of time to make that happen. However, it's probably not going to happen because a lot of the green agenda, the climate change agenda, seems to be about being able to micromanage people's lives. Hey, don't eat meat anymore. Eat bugs. So every little aspect of our lives is being impacted by this crazy agenda. And if you were to put up a bunch of nuclear power plants, providing green, stable, reliable energy, a lot of the rationale for some of the public policy would be undercut. So I hate to say it, but I think that is one of the reasons. And the other reason is that there is an irrational fear of nuclear power. So before we could implement a green nuclear power agenda, there would have to be a lot of education to help dispel some of the fears. A lot more could be said about the anti-reality agenda being propelled by climate change fears. But suffice it to say that it is one of the major, major narratives that is negatively impacting the lives of people in this country and around the world. That is not to say that we can't get something positive out of a pro-environmental attitude. But sadly, as is the case far too often, extremists have taken over the public policy agenda, and thus we end up with public policy that lacks common sense, that's not based on science, and consequently is doing far more damage than good. Speaking of damage, our support for the One China policy established, I believe, by Nixon and Kissinger under the realpolitik thinking has done a lot of damage, and it's time that we reverse that. Far too often when people discuss Taiwan, there is a mindset it is a tiny little place sitting uncomfortably close to China. After all, it only has 23 million people. It's actually smaller than the city of Shanghai in China that has 25 million people. But while Taiwan's population is small compared to mega countries like China, India, and the United States, it is much larger than many well-known, well-recognized countries, including Sweden at 10 million, Greece at 10 million, Portugal at 10 million, Israel at 9.5 million, Austria at 9 million, Chile at 19 million, the Netherlands at 17.7 million, Cambodia at 15.5 million, El Salvador at 6.8 million, and it is nearly as big as Australia with 25.9 million people. In fact, there are over 100 countries with less population than Taiwan. Why is this important? It is important because by every normal standard, Taiwan is a thriving independent country that has the 21st largest GDP in the world, and its people, refugees from the brutality of Mao Zedong's murder of over 65 million people, have fought hard to overcome fascism and become a true democracy. In fact, there is little doubt that the Taiwanese people value democracy, and they achieved it themselves. And international observers describe Taiwanese elections as free, fair, and highly competitive. The U.S. State Department describes Taiwan as a leading democracy and a technological powerhouse. Taiwan is a key U.S. partner in the Indo-Pacific. Further, Taiwan is the United States' eighth largest trading partner, and the United States is Taiwan's second largest trading partner. Taiwan is definitely a thriving democracy, but China is not. China is one of the world's worst human rights abusers. China does not have free elections, does not have a free market, and China considers the United States to be its enemy. China has been stealing over $300 billion in intellectual property annually from the United States year after year after year. China has been using predatory trade practices to destroy key U.S. industries, and China is responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic. If China does conquer Taiwan, it will mean the deaths of many hundreds of thousands, and it will make the world a less free and less safe place. It will position China for further aggression. And make no mistake, China is not Russia. China is a true superpower, militarily, technologically, and economically, and with a billion-plus people, well, you can't ignore that. Further, it is the trillions of dollars of U.S. trade deficits that have funded the massive buildup of the Chinese military that has put them into the position to threaten Taiwan. So we are responsible, to a high degree, for the situation Taiwan finds itself in. Consequently, it is time for the United States to fully recognize Taiwan as the independent, free democracy that it is and reject the one China policy. And one of the first things we should do is help Taiwan acquire air independent propulsion submarines. The reason I mention modern diesel electric submarines, the latest version of which is the air independent propulsion submarine, is that submarines in today's world are some of the most cost-effective deterrents, especially for a nation with a big coast to protect, and especially when trying to deter an amphibious assault. Over the last 30 years, we have seen just how effective these submarines can be, and just how ineffective even modern ASW, anti-submarine warfare, is against these submarines. In the 1980s, Argentina and Britain got into a war known as the Falklands War, and in that war, the British Navy was able to pretty much hang around the Argentine coast and dominate, with one exception, and that exception was an Argentina submarine, a Type 209 submarine built in the 1960s. This lone submarine was able to create chaos among the British naval forces. In fact, it was able to conduct several successful attack runs, and if its torpedoes had not been duds, it likely would have sunk at least a couple of British Navy ships. But the bottom line is, the British Navy was never able to stop that submarine. They launched over 200 anti-submarine warfare munitions at it, and it didn't suffer a scratch. And it finished out the 10-week war, you know, in the same kind of condition it went into. In 2005, exercises were conducted between the U.S. Navy and Sweden had its lone, brand-new Gotland-class submarine, named the Gotland. This was a diesel-electric, air-independent propulsion submarine that could stay underwater for several weeks at a time. Raid against the Gotland was the entire carrier task force, including multiple anti-submarine warfare ships, anti-submarine warfare helicopters, and at least one nuclear attack sub. The bottom line is, over a period of several days, the Gotland successfully and repeatedly penetrated the anti-submarine warfare screen set up around the USS Ronald Reagan and was able to launch multiple successful attacks against the Reagan. Obviously, they were simulated attacks, but by the end of the exercises, it is reported that U.S. anti-submarine warfare forces were fairly demoralized. Now, that was just one submarine. The U.S. naval forces knew that it was coming. If Taiwan, and with support from the United States and allies like Japan and maybe Australia, can deploy a number of subs, both nuclear and diesel electric, into the Taiwan Strait, China would have its hands full. Those subs would be able to sink any large amphibious force trying to cross over the Taiwan Strait. The only question is would Taiwan's allies, including the United States, have the will to do that? So that's the real question. The question is not as whether or not we have the capability to stop China. The question is, do we have the will to stop China? On that note, we'll call it a wrap. Until next time, vaya con Dios.